Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events in our central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for this hour, along with engineer Mike Murphy and our neighbor and Milford Township resident, Pat Schlerbaum. Anna Magnuson, alias Anna Banana, will join our bunch later in the hour to share her heart-to-heart and tune-in Tuesday messages. You know, Pat, trees were an important piece of the last week's events, especially during our Earth Day appreciation. These important citizens of our natural world, quoting Sylvan Runkle, provide for our mental well-being and in carbon sequestration, habitat fulfillment. You know, I'm just naming a few. They're important also symbolically. I think of poetry, prose.
How about just the colors that they emit this time of year? We think of the autumn colors, but the varying shades of green and the blue flower blossoms and the shade that's coming.
Yeah, yesterday we certainly could have used that toward the end of the day. I was cooking there, man.
Yeah.
In fact, we were all kind of outdoors, and I think we were reporting this morning that, gosh, you start out with a down vest in the morning and you're sweating by the afternoon. So
who knew? Well, and it created morel mushrooms, I'm pretty sure, too.
Pat, we had you accompanied me. We had a chance to visit a local craftsman, Luke Ulrich, the proprietor of Great Plains Millwork. That's located in Nevada, Iowa, just east of Ames. And he shared his appreciation with us of this valuable resource. Luke Ulrich, Great Plains Millwork. Thank you, Luke, for allowing us to visit with you today. How did you get started?
I've been doing this for about 30 years, and I needed a hobby. I needed something to do after work. I just kind of started getting into woodwork. Started watching Norm and on Saturday afternoons.
This old house
and Woodwright Shop. I started watching those fellows and then kind of started getting interested in it. Just found out I kind of enjoyed it. I had a friend who was restoring his house from the late 1800s and he needed some moldings. My friend Craig asked if I could do that, and so I gave it a try, and I found out there's kind of a niche market in the area for that. That's kind of what prompted me to start trying to advertise that for people, because you can't go to Menards or Lowe's and find those moldings. It seems to help people out that way. Yeah, so this is actually a customer from Wisconsin,
okay,
in the Milwaukee area.
Yeah.
The big shops there didn't want to deal with him. So if you have a home with, you only need 20 feet or 100 feet or want to do the whole home, I can do that. So this fellow from Wisconsin sent me a sample in the mail. I made a template, and then I grind the knives. And the next step will be just simply to run that molding.
How long does it take to make a template? Essentially, you're customizing a cutter.
A template can take about an hour. The better it matches the sample, mm-hmm, the better when I grind the cutter. Now, the cutter is ground on a special grinder that looks somewhat like the old-fashioned key grinder in the hardware store. The template goes into the front of the machine, and a tracer finger will follow that template. And then I have the knife stock, the head, that will go into the machine.
Okay.
And then I slowly grind the knife. So a pair of knives like I normally make can take a couple hours to get those just right.
The piece here, you've got two knives on that.
This is a shaper cutter head.
Shaper cutter head.
Yes, there's two knives, and so this will rotate at around 6,000 RPMs. Material will go through either a shaper or a spindle molder, like they call it over in Europe. It'll go through a molder, depending upon how elaborate or how large that piece is. It was a bit of trial and error to get it just right. I find out through the years, the woodworking community, they're very generous in offering information and helping someone starting out or answering questions. I went to school in Waterloo. I'm from northern Minnesota. Grew up in my dad's welding shop. The skills I got from my stepdad, I came down to Waterloo and went to Hawkeye Tech. And I went to school for industrial machine repair. The metalworking skills came from dad,
okay,
and from trade school. That's something I noticed growing up in northern Minnesota. Dad did a lot of repair work on logging equipment.
Yeah.
And other guys would come in with a paper sketch of a sawmill they wanted to have built 40, 50 years ago, which is rather than buy it, they would build it. They weren't intimidated giving something a try, they would just, why not? So they would trial and error. I saw some pretty creative things come through Dad's welding shop, and it was guys just willing to try it, not give up.
Have you ever taken on any apprentices or any young people interested in woodworking?
I have not. One of my customers, he's a scout instructor, so we had a bunch of Cub Scouts here once, and that was pretty fun. And I'd like to do that more often, but I seem to be getting more busy as time goes on, so finding that time for things like that.
There were probably a few of those scouts that appreciated that, that's for sure.
That was a lot of fun. Their dads or grandpas that were with them had a lot
of fun.
There
you go. Yeah,
doing that with them.
Starts as the apprentice, the youngster, and then the father and grandfather realizes, hey, I'd like to know how to do this too.
Well, sure. I think starting at that young age, building your own toolbox or a pine wood derby gives a lot of boldness in a young person's skills and thinking, why not? You don't have to buy everything. You can build a lot of things. This shop that we're standing in now is my small machine shop, and I don't really do machining for other people. Mm-hmm. But as I give you a tour of the shop, you'll see some of the old equipment that I've restored over the years. So this was my dad's milling machine and his lathe. The lathe is from 1942. I'm really proud to say that the Navy used to own that. I always say that helped win the war. So from Waterloo, it went up to Bemidji.
Mm-hmm.
My father passed away about 15 years ago, and I wanted to keep that. And so I purchased that from my mother and then brought it down here and restored it. Those the cutters are made over here on this. It's a special grinder. And so the template would come in to this portion, a tracing finger, and it has a special grinding head. You just slowly take a little bit off at a time, drink some coffee.
But you don't have that high school kid here to sweep up the shavings and things like cleanup.
I have a lot of retired gentlemen that stop in and visit once in a while, and they're always offering to grab a broom and hang out for the day.
I found myself at the wrong end of a broom back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah. So this is a small machine shop, and this is how I either make the knives or maintain the machinery that we have here. You'll notice all these knives. I haven't run all of these, but they don't necessarily go bad. As long as I have a template or need to make a template for them, I can resharpen them. What this works really well for is I can show the client. They'll bring a sample in, and then I can show them, here's what happens. I can match that sample up to a piece of brand new millwork. Mm-hmm. So this is why they come, is they can't buy this pattern anymore.
Is this just a pine?
Yep, this is probably longleaf pine. This is more modern.
Like a yellow pine.
Getting the color to match is very complicated with that.
Sure. Aging alone would change the color too.
It does.
So you notice an old growth versus a new growth as far as looking at the growth rings on,
absolutely,
on those pieces.
Yes. Customers come in, and they have a choice. They can either hire me to match their pattern exactly, or I might have something real similar in profile. That's close enough. I've had that happen quite frequently. So they might be fixing up the basement into the man cave or a family room down there, and they just want to put some moldings down there with some character. It might not be an exact match, but it'd be really close.
Do you have an idea how many knives you have?
Maybe 1,000.
Steel, I assume.
It's high-speed steel. This would be real similar to the same steel that you would find on a drill bit. So it can handle the abrasiveness of the wood. It'll handle the heat. And it can also be sharpened and hold a nice, keen edge.
Do you resharpen your own
blades? Yes. With the template, I can just put it right back in the grinding machine, and then I can resharpen it. Some woods, like white oak, is very hard. Oh, think of it like if you took your pocket knife and cut a piece of pine or cut a piece of oak, you would notice right away there's a difference. Some woods, yes, they have silicates in it, and they're abrasive, but mostly for red oak, cut really nice. White oak is a bit harder. That will generate a lot of heat, and once the knife starts to get some heat to it, the edge starts to fail. It's not really too big of an issue here for me because I'm not running 7, 8, 10,000 linear feet. A run for me might just be 100 feet or 200 feet. It hasn't really been too big of an issue.
That heat affects the temper.
Exactly.
And the edge of that cutting surface.
Right.
Okay.
This is the main shop. This building was built in 1940. It was the Farmall dealership back then. And once in a while, I'll have an older gentleman stop in and
tell me how he remembers coming here with his grandfather. Apparently this place had an old Coke machine. So back in 1940, there probably wasn't a lot of Coca-Cola machines. They came down here with Grandpa because they could get a Coke. And I guess they had a peanut machine also, I hear about. So okay. It's been owned by several other companies along the way. Lumber will come in, and I can plane it. I have a 30-inch planer. So the wood will come in a rough form.
Rough cut.
I don't have a sawmill, and dealing with that is an awful lot of work. So I just leave making the lumber to the people, the sawyer, with the sawmill and a kiln. I will buy it rough, and then I have a planer, and that will take it to a certain thickness, and then I will size the wood accordingly. So whether I'm building furniture or making trim, I have to size the wood. Back here, I don't just make moldings for people. I also make furniture, custom cabinetry and things on that name.
Beautiful stuff.
Thank you. This is a piece of spalted maple. This came from northeast Wisconsin. Out of the forest it came from, there were only two trees that had this much spalting. So the tree is dead. Moisture, you know, can either be standing, this one was standing, or it can be in the log pile. The moisture is in there, trapped, and the bacteria gets in it, and then it creates a pattern in it. This one's really spectacular. So this one's sold. This bought this plank. There's a local gentleman, Andrew Drake. He builds custom guitars, and this will be a guitar top someday. This is pocket.
Maple?
This is maple with bark pockets in it. It's kind of disfigured, but because it's so odd, this would make a really nice piece in a door panel, something on that nature.
Once you put a finish surface on it, it'll just bring that pattern out.
It'll really be pretty spectacular. And this is a flame birch. It's kind of got a figure to it, and when you put some stain on it or some dye, that'll look like it's just on fire. This is the Peshtigo wood.
This whole stack?
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a friend in Wisconsin, and I go and buy figured hardwoods from Bob Close, and his specialty is dealing with finding figured hardwoods. So we saw the maple over here and the figured hardwoods, because that's not going to be around here in Iowa, in the Northwoods. So Bob deals with finding spectacular figured hardwoods. Somebody approached him about some logs that were pulled out of Peshtigo River. My understanding is there was a sawmill along the river in that area, and the sawmill was burnt down. And sawmills would have a big pond where they keep the logs. Once the fire happened, the sawmill burnt down. The logs got waterlogged and sank. And so these were in the river that pond for 150 years. My understanding is these are probably about 300 years old when they were cut down. So birch is normally almost vanilla in color, very light. But because this sat in a pond, it got mineral deposits. There's no oxygen, so it doesn't rot. And it just takes on all those deposits all those years, turns it some color. Here you see a piece with just a clear finish on it. And this is a piece in this section with just a clear oil stain.
So this, you're experimenting somewhat with this for your finishes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I can show the customer, because when they look at the wood, this is rough.
Right.
And
pretty dull looking.
Pretty dull. Yeah, it looks neat. But when they see this, quite amazing, because this is something completely different than you're going to find at the lumberyard now. Something I've learned over the years, as soon as somebody sees a piece of figured wood, or a piece of wood they want to enjoy, that they really enjoy looking at, they want to put their hand on it and just feel what that feels like. And I've noticed that. They'll come in here after it has a finish on it, and they'll put their hand on it.
Chips, dust. Do you have somebody come and pick that up?
I have one customer. He has a small farm, and once in a while he'll come over and pick up some.
For bedding or something
for bedding.
Like that.
I wish I could find some more people that were interested. If we have farmers listening, and they're interested in having some shavings, I would be happy to pass it on.
You know, you might just put a little sign out and say, shavings for bedding. Or
you all, exactly.
What prompted you to call your place, or to name your place, Great Plains Millwork?
Along the years, I've collected hand planes. I have a fairly large collection of old molding planes that would put a pattern on a piece of wood. So before they had electricity, they had molding planes. I have a cabinet with those, so which is, and then Plains is kind of a play on words from the Great Plains State. I've had one phone call over the years, somebody calling to order a pizza from Great Plains.
Hey, look at this, Pat. How do you collect these?
eBay is where I've picked up most of these, or antique shops.
And I told myself, when it's full, I'm done, and which is a good thing because...
It's close to full.
It's close to full, and they can get kind of pricey after a while.
Are those adjustable shelves?
Or, yes.
Because I could see you might have to collect one more layer.
No. So these molding planes are really fascinating. A lot of them had a maker's mark in it.
Sure.
So this one is Wallace. There was a husband and wife years ago that went through the census records. On the census records, that would list that was your occupation.
Okay.
If you were a plane maker, that was listed on the census record. These people played detective and found out where these molding planes were made and what year.
Mm-hmm.
Because the census records would say Wallace built was in Connecticut. Here we go. This one was made from either 1869 to 74.
Wow.
By a man named A. Howland.
Howland and Company, huh?
Yeah.
Out of New York.
The really neat thing is they're still usable. And so I've made moldings with these for people. They'll come in needing a molding for their house, and it might just be a couple feet. I'll just grab one of these molding planes and go old school with it. So I don't have to make a cutter. I don't have to turn a router table on or a shaper or anything.
So do you feel different using something like this that somebody made? Do you feel a connection with that maker?
I never really thought about that, but somewhat. It's exciting to get to use that, and then... To the customer is kind of excited because a lot of times that's how they were made, some of those moldings. There's some romance involved with
yeah.
that. When I had the Cub Scouts here, I had a molding plane out and I let the youngsters try it out and they got a big kick out of that. Some
yeah.
of the first cordless tools. So the old woodworking tools are still usable.
Well, when you're honoring craftsmen that came before, you're probably onto something of real value. You know, their life mattered and your customers will feel that, oh, this is beyond just honoring Luke and Great Plains. This goes right back to the source,
yeah.
you know, in
yeah.
many respects.
Oh, yeah, the boy can do it.
Yeah, well, the music was courtesy of Luke Ulrich. He had a lot of speakers around his shop in different rooms in different parts of the shop. Each had these large stereo speakers. So as we were departing, I thought to ask him what he might have on his tape player or on the turntable. And he said, Dire Straits, which is appropriate music for a woodworking shop.
Yep, got to keep that straight. Yeah. So, you know, he mentioned the wood from the Peshtigo sawmill pond. Some of our listeners may not realize this, but when timber, prior to a lot of railroad and trucking, a lot of timber was moved by river. In fact, for Iowa, Burlington was a really big area. They would float the logs down from the north, the Mississippi, and in Burlington's area, they would capture that. But on the Peshtigo River, that was another way. Peshtigo actually is northeastern part of the state of Wisconsin, and it flows into the Green Bay. And Peshtigo itself is located right near the west shoreline of the Green Bay. And so this holding pond has these logs. Well, what happened, he talked about the sawmill burning down. And that burned because of the result of the Peshtigo fire that happened in 1871. The reason I know this is because it burned over three counties in the state of Wisconsin, Shawano County being one of those. And my great-grandparents had their farm in Shawano County. And we also talked about some other things. I've got a board from that barn that I've framed a picture of their family, all my great aunts and my grandmother, as little kids. And I've got that photo of that barn and the kids framed in that piece of wood. But that we don't want to go down that rabbit hole. We want to continue. The Peshtigo Fire, 1871, occurred at the same time the Chicago Fire occurred. But because news didn't travel as fast as it did, Chicago Fire got the billing, the top billing, the heat of the day, as it were. And unfortunately, they don't have good records, but anywhere from 1,000 to over 2,000 folks perhaps perished in that fire up in the Peshtigo area. They could not outrun that forest fire. They used trains. What few trains they had. They hit the river. They tried to get to this ponds in that area to escape the flames. There was also another fire across the Green Bay, which at that point is over 14 miles wide. On the peninsula, there was a fire burning at that same time, and folks thought that the embers had started that fire. Well, that was misinformation. There was another fire that started that, and that burned most of the Door County area. But what prompted this was it was a dry, hot season. But as they were clearing land for farming, these fires were a way to clear, and they got out of hand. And the only structure that survived the fire in Peshtigo was the Catholic Church. And unfortunately, we didn't have time to talk to Luke about the fact that he had a Catholic family in town in Nevada that is actually got a project for some of that wood. When they heard that, you know, it had that connection, they thought that was some great wood. And that wood is beautiful. It has its character of its own. And I may just have to visit and see if I can get a few scraps of molding to see if, because I got a few photos of structures in that area. I might just have to see if I can get a picture frame, enough for a picture frame.
And he shared a piece of that wood that was from the Peshtigo holding ponds, from wood that had been there for 100 years. And that was quite a gift and quite a sharing. Quite a guy, that Luke. All right, at Great Plains,
yeah,
millwork.
He also Luke mentioned that he had, there's a few other structures in Nevada. Oh, the bakery, for example. He's gone in some of the casework and that he's worked on that. He does a lot of custom projects. And who knew when you were driving down East Lincoln Way, just on the way out of Nevada, on the north side, there's this old building. He referred to it as the Massey Ferguson dealership back in the 40s. And, I've driven by there many times and assuming that it's a millwork place, but there's probably six or seven individuals in there making molding and things like that. And who knew that it was this one craftsman started out as a hobby. And I know we made a comment that, well, this is more than a hobby, Luke. But that you could just feel the passion that he had for the wood. And, you know, if he had more time, I know you could tell he really enjoyed having the Cub Scouts there. And I'm sure he enjoys the visits, but gosh, the guy has a lot of projects going on.
Well, not only with his creations of wood, but the mechanical machines that he's refurbished to create those beautiful works of art. Starting with the planes, the wood planes, but man, everything was just refurbished and beautiful, pristine. You can see he's really quite a machinist also.
Right. A good example of a local individual with a craft, and that's one of the reasons KHOI, our community radio, we like to find folks like this. He gave us a lead. He talked about a custom guitar maker in the Nevada area. So I know there's a few musicians associated with us. We may have to follow up on that sometime.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Pat, Susan Guiasta is joining in. And good morning, Susan. How are you today?
Nice to see everybody again.
Yeah. It looks like you had a refreshing recovery from our Earth Day appreciation event on Saturday. I hope you got out to actually enjoy the outdoors a little bit.
Well, first of all, what a great event. That was so much fun. You get so nervous about these things and how are they all going to work and how's it all going to come together? But there were so many people and I just thought it worked beautifully. I thought it was wonderful. I want to thank KHOI, all the volunteers and everybody that worked so hard to put that together. Well, you know, it's great that you mentioned that event because one of the voices that I was not able to fit into the schedule of that action-packed Saturday was our own traffic engineer, Damian Pregitzer. He does a lot with traffic design, traffic flow, data collection about traffic. And he's always working to find ways to make traffic flow through Ames more efficiently. There's a lot of cool things on the horizon, some new technology and ways to improve traffic flow. And I wish we could have had Damian with us on Saturday, but he has agreed to come with us this morning.
Well, that's great. Good. Hello there, Damian. How are you?
Good. How is everyone this morning?
We're doing well. We could have used you Saturday. I was the traffic coordinator to keep us on time, and Pat was the director. We were able to. I think we had fun. It seemed like it. We were sitting here in the studio at one point. Mike said, "It's at like 2:30 in the afternoon." And he goes, "Is the morning over yet?" It was going. Fortunately, it went in a smooth manner, and I'm sure that's what your goal is with Ames traffic, is to make sure that it continues to travel in a smooth manner.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, any traffic engineer you'll ever speak to, of course, safety is always the highest priority, then efficiency. And one of the things that kind of, I think, hopefully we'll get gains from both, like Susan was talking about, is The thing for Ames, I think, that has always been our Achilles heel, it has maybe been a technology for our ability to manage our transportation system, especially communication systems. So right now we use what is essentially copper wire that you would use on an old school telephone to be able for our signals to be able to speak to each other and that sort of thing is even, I would say, problematic to impossible to collect data from. So manually collecting data, fairly slow communication between the signals, things like that. So We have a project that's coming up where we're going to modernize all of that. So we have, it's called the Intelligent Transportation System. So if you look at it in the city's capital plan, it would be the ITS program. And what that's going to do is it's going to upgrade all the signal cabinets. So we'll get newer technology, but then it's going to replace all that copper with fiber optics. So the same kind of stuff that private sector is using for high-speed internet would be the same kind of fiber optics that we would be connecting all our signals together. So that lets us access everything essentially instantaneously. All the upgrades to the signals lets us use data, or I should say it provides access to data that's out there. So I'll give an example. Every time in the past, every time when a vehicle, a pedestrian, a bike would come up to a signal, there's some kind of sensor that says, hey, there's somebody here, you need to do something. Well, that information, if you kind of think about it, it's happening all the time, but that information is a wealth of information that if you don't collect it, can just disappear and you can't do anything with it. These new signal upgrades is going to let us collect all that information. So every time a car comes up to a signal, somebody pushes a button, a bike is detected, the new controller is going to capture that data in its memory and we can access it through this network. So all of a sudden, it's kind of like walking around in a dark room, bumping against stuff you think you know is there, but it's like somebody, boom, they turn the lights on and you get to see everything in the room all at once. So it's going to be a wealth of information I think we've never had.
So here I thought all those little signal cabinets were, we had folks of smaller stature in those, and when you'd see somebody, they were actually passing them sandwiches and coffee and things because they were the ones monitoring the crossings. And then I also had this idea that I was sitting at a stop sign, and we've got a few areas, intersections like this. There's absolutely no traffic coming from the other direction, and there's this long time. And I'm thinking here, they must know my car, and they're out to get me. They don't want me to move. So, in that vein, do you have targeted areas? How are you going to go about this? Do you have a schedule on as far as what intersections you're going to deal with first?
Yeah. So the program is eventually going to cover everything in the entire city. So it will be a citywide program, but we're starting with the Duff Avenue corridor. Obviously, it gets the most traffic, but it's Duff all the way from the new, it's Crystal Street, where there's a new gas station down
right
there.
South.
All the way up to 13th Street by the hospital, and then it's going to swing over to Dayton, because that's part of the prioritization isn't just the corridor itself, but all these fiber and networking stuff needs to be in buildings. Like, some of it can be out in the field, but some of it needs to be in a building so that it's protected. So it goes like this. It goes Duff, then eastern part of Lincoln Way, then Grand, then the western part of Lincoln Way, University, and then kind of everything else. So hopefully we'll get it all done in probably 5, maybe 6 years, depending on funding.
Okay. I know there's a lot of folks that, especially when you're traveling 13th West and you're going through the University piece there along Sheldon and then up the through the corridor past Pamel Woods under the railroad track and then up into the Ontario area, there's a lot of traffic, especially at those high peak times. And I was just wondering if that is one of the earlier parts of the mix. Now, for me, that doesn't matter because I take East 13th or a road in that direction and go between Ames and Nevada. But overall, I did it right. I live on the east side, so I'm not looking into the sun when I go into town.
And that is smart.
When I used to work at Iowa State, I'd have the sun at my back going home. So
I was exact opposite. When you live on the west side of Ames, yeah, exactly, and work on the east side.
Yeah.
What I would tell you is that, one of the things that I think you're talking about coming up to a signal or waiting or trying to get traffic flow to work better through a certain area Well, going back to my comment earlier about, you know, kind of doing it the old way, using the only tools that we had at our disposal, was that in the past, you know, before this new technology is available to us, in the past, if we wanted to study something, so you're talking about going PAML through, you know, 13th to right. Ontario, somebody would have to go out there, probably some poor intern. I guess they're getting experience, so you can't, you know, decry that too much. But you'd send out interns, and they would go out and manually count intersections mm-hmm. for hours. And if they could stay awake long enough, I did it, by the way, when I was in college, and it is brutal. It is tough. But you get to about hour three or four, and you start losing your mind. You're just sitting there counting cars for that long of time is very hard mentally. So, and then, you know, you bring that data back. It probably takes 3 to 4 days. You put it in the software. It you know, you can model things. You make some estimates. And you really only have, what, 4 hours, 6 hours, maybe, if you're lucky, 8 hours of one day, of one week, of one month to time that entire corridor. See, that's the great thing. All that goes away with this new system because it's continuously collecting data. So it collects all the counts every day, every hour. So, you know, if you ever got stopped at a signal and you're like, well, why am I waiting? I don't know why. Well, it's probably because the old way of counting and coming up with a timing plan was really lumpy. You know, mm-hmm. it was really trying to average out a lot of unknown information. This system, especially one of the features of it, is it'll adapt real time to traffic. So
you're not taking a snapshot. You're actually doing real-time data collection, it sounds like, so it's dynamic as opposed to a static system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are times where when the day is pretty much, you know, people going to work like we were just talking about, like a Monday is probably going to be the same in Ames, but for special events. So I would say, you know, 80% of Mondays for traffic probably look very similar, especially when you start looking at you know, information from the system. So those we could probably put together as a fixed. But then, you know, what's great about this kind of system is you'd have a range, like your options are kind of limitless, right? So you might have some fixed timing plans, but then it could say, whoa, I'm looking at, so it also collects like historical data. So one of the cool features I think is really neat that's going to make things more efficient and smarter is that it'll have historical data, right? So it'll be looking at, well, a normal Monday looks like this, but I'm not seeing what I should be seeing for a normal Monday. There's something different going on. And then the system can switch to like an adaptive real-time operation. So it's that kind of stuff that, you know, we've never had an option for, and it is, it's expensive, but we're using congestion mitigation money to be able to implement this program. So it's going to be, I think, pretty cool.
Yeah. So Damien, one of the complaints we often get is people perceive our traffic signals as not being synchronized. And one of the complaints about that is that idling cars, you know, produce a lot of carbon, and a more efficient system would be better for the environment. Is that what we see happening with this system?
Yeah, like so our signals are coordinated now. One of the things that I think the reason why people think it's not coordinated is because the type of operation. So what our signals let us do is it lets, like, if there isn't people, like, so there's traffic coming from the side street. If there's only one car and it's their time in the signal cycle to come back out onto the street, but it'll do an early release back to the main street. So that signal, though it's green on the main street, isn't in coordination. So it has to wait till it gets back to its part of the cycle. So, but that goes back to my comment about it being lumpy. So under the new system, it's like it is coordinated now, but it's coordinated with a very little information, as much information as we can, you know, physically, and it's expensive too, by the way, to collect data manually. The new system, we'll be able to get rid of all that waste. So it'll be looking at lost time, wasted time, like you're talking about green lights with no cars there, because, you know, we'd have information that would be telling us the signal's green, but there's nobody at the sensor. So we'd be able to look at that data, or the system will do it automatically and just get rid of it. It'll adjust time so that you don't need that. Because the one sin that you have for any kind of traffic signal is you can't waste green time. Your only currency you have is that green time. So that data, the modernized system, will make sure that we can squeeze like every bit of, you know, juice out of the lemon kind of thing.
Yeah, that would, what Susan brought up is something that is in the back of your mind about idling, that's for sure. I know out in California, for example, they're probably have this in at least some of their urban areas, I would think, this type of information gathering, updated because of their need to try to stay ahead of the curve for air pollution, for smog problems, that kind of thing, I'm sure. Damien, what's going to happen to all that copper? Are we going to see a plunge in the copper market when we recycle?
No, because the copper wire is what we use to power everything else. So
okay.
There's definitely not a reduced demand for copper. But we do, I tell you what, you'd be surprised that for the economics of this of the upgrade is that we will probably get a fair amount of money that helps us locally. You know, when people are talking about recycling, there's a lot of companies that will come in and they want to buy that copper. They'll strip it out and they'll recycle the jacket that it's in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll take the copper, and I'm sure they strip it down to its element pieces and recycle it completely. So that copper probably is worth a fair amount of, I mean, we haven't figured it out because we haven't put the project out to bid. But the stuff that's out there definitely won't go to waste. I mean, somebody will want it,
sure.
We'll pile it up, and they'll buy it for sure.
That sounds great. Damien, is there anything else you want to add to this to try to speed up our traffic a little bit? Or?
Well, I would say a lot of people would not want speed to be what any of the things that we're increasing. But so Susan was talking about the greenhouse gas emissions for efficiency. Well, that's so the money that I was talking about that we're getting that's paying for this whole program. One of the ways you get that money is you do a study. And so every corridor that we've gotten funded, I wish I had it off the top of my head, but we go through so there's like NOx, carbon dioxide, all the different greenhouse gases you list out and what you think this upgrade is going to reduce. So, I'm pretty excited. I think it was somewhere. Don't quote me on this. You probably can quote me.
We won't air this part.
Yeah. I think it was somewhere around 10 to 15%. And it's very conservative estimate as far as greenhouse gas. So we should see probably a significant increase in efficiency right out of the gate with this type of system. So that those pollutants that are out there, I think ozone is another thing that's a major pollutant caused by, you know, idling vehicles,
right,
that we'd want to get rid of. So, yeah, I mean, it's an efficiency thing for the city. It'll be a great impact for the environment. I hope the other thing, too, that maybe we hadn't thought about when you think about just making signals more efficient, is that there's only so much time out that you can allocate to a signal, right? And a lot of times, you know, we want to make things more friendly for walking and biking. And so you think about like, okay, well, if I have to slice the pie up, how much can I slice and give to, you know, each different mode, a car, a bike, somebody walking? Well, what's great about this new system is that essentially we're wasting some of the pie right now. Well, so we can collect some of that back. We don't have to give it to vehicles, because they're fairly well managed, but some of our bike and walking, to make those things more efficient, more nicer, essentially, those are something that we can make improvements to with as well. So, you know, whereas in the past, we're really conservative about how we designed intersections. Maybe they weren't very ped friendly, very bike friendly, because we were trying to get capacity for cars. So this system, because it'll be more efficient and less wasteful, is going to improve every aspect of transportation, not just efficiency, but also like how we design. So it opens up more opportunities to make things more walking and bike friendly too,
yeah.
Which is, as you can imagine, if you're not driving a car, that's also making things more environmentally friendly too.
Right. It you point out the ped friendly or the pedestrian friendly. That's definitely a way we want to try to, well, it saves on the greenhouse gases and keeps us healthier. if we're willing to ambulate on our own. You use the term NOx, and for our listeners, that's nitrous oxide. I didn't want to interrupt your flow there.
No, that's fine.
Before we go to I know Susan's got a couple of announcements, at least one I can think of that we need to talk about real briefly here. Anything else, Damien?
No, I think it's going to be great. And like I said, I think next, what I should say is in 2022, so 2022, in that summer is when we expect to start our construction on it.
Very good.
It takes a lot of planning and design to start with to get all the pieces and parts right. And then once we get a contractor on board, so we should start seeing improvements, I think, by fall, like when the students would come back in 22.
Damien, what a great report for the follow-up to the Earth Day Appreciation Saturday. And keep up the good work. I'm glad we were able to include your message today.
Yep, thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Susan, May 1st is coming up. I knew you have an announcement about that.
Oh, I have. Yes, absolutely. The Lowhead Dam ribbon cutting and open house celebration will begin at 10 a.m. on Saturday. That's this coming Saturday at North River Valley Park. The weather looks great. Just park there by the ball fields and walk back to the shelter. Join us for that event. Again, 10 a.m. to 10:30 is the actual ceremony, followed by booths and tables, and we're going to give away some free tree seedlings. And you can get more information about local organizations and sustainability. Also, just a few other things. Tonight is a city council meeting, 6 p.m. on Zoom. Please join us. Our agenda and supplemental material is on our website, cityofames.org/ccmeetings. So that's a quick way to get there. And just remember, get your bikes ready to go. The Mayor's Bike Ride is coming up on Saturday, May 15th, 9 a.m. Meet at the City Hall West parking lot.
Sounds great. Sounds like a lot of nice spring activities. And we're planning to be there for the ribbon cutting. So, let's put it this way. I don't think I'm going to be wearing my swim trunks because we'll just be there. And if we get wet, we get wet. But it'll be fun. It sounds like a fun event.
We'll be happy to see you.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. Anna Magnuson, what's going on here? Day-o! I think Harry's banana boat is up in the day, still in the plantation. Mike can't get the boat.
So he missed the boat?
Yeah, he missed the boat. So here's Anna.
All right. Well, I still love the introduction. That was great singing, guys. And it is Tune In Tuesday as I try and tempt you to listen to KHOI. So I'm going to start with a poem by Joy Harjo, who is an American poet, musician, playwright, and author. She is the incumbent United States Poet Laureate, the first Native American to hold that honor. And here's the poem I selected to kick off the Heart to Heart Tune In Tuesday segment for Local Talk. The poem is titled, Perhaps the World Ends Here. The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it. Babies teeth at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. At this table, we gossip, we call enemies, and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor falling down selves as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. The table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It's a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite. So that is a poem by Joy Harjo to help me share that Lydia English, the Strategic Initiatives Coordinator at Practical Farmers of Iowa, will be joining the dynamic duo Donna and Lana at their kitchen table today. And they will be talking about climate change, rural food security and equity, the politics of agroecology, and how it impacts what we put on our plate on the Donna Lana Kitchen Show. So again, what is this Donna Lana Kitchen Show? Donna Lana Kitchen Show talks about food, farming, recipes, advice, and opinions. Chef Donna and Farmer Lana explore the local food scene with lively discussion and good humor on Tuesdays at noon and repeated at 7 p.m. So, Mike Metz, what happens when your dinner table catches the coronavirus?
Well, Anna Banana, what does happen to my kitchen table when it catches the coronavirus?
It turns into a coffee table. So before we dine at our dinner or our coffee table as I do, what will we hear if we tune in and listen to you and Sam discussing on Science Bites today? Dun,
well,
dun,
dun. Well, I don't think you want to be eating when we handle this subject. We're talking about the banning of DDT. We're continuing our last week, we're going to wrap up how DDT was the information that was used, and Irv was instrumental in that, by the way, as far as how it affected the egg thickness, shell thickness. That was one of his studies, but he's going to share with us some information on that and how DDT was banned from use in the United States.
And that's Dr. Irv Kloss.
Dr. Irv Kloss.
Very good. So after you listen to the fun and charming guys make science interesting, you can tune in tonight at 8:30 p.m. to find out what songs I match to the message and conversation that are part of the show. Now, tonight's show showcases how I have adopted the belief that stories can unify us by reminding us of our shared, extraordinary humanity, and that even the seemingly ordinary moments have the power to illuminate, as shared by the award-winning artist, Akwi Engi, who will have the honor of sharing this hour with us to hear more about her story. She specializes in creative personal narrative storytelling across artistic mediums. Her work and words have appeared on stage from California's Wine Country to New York's Fashion Week. So let's see if you can guess from me reading the lyrics of one of tonight's songs.
Oh, I know what it is.
Well, you have to listen first.
Oh, okay.
Wait for it. To all those honor oneself and acknowledges and encourages one's own power to accomplish and overcome, I dedicate these lyrics to you. I won't just survive, oh, you will see me thrive. Can't write my story, I'm beyond the archetype. I won't just conform, no matter how you shake my core, because my roots, they run deep. All right, now you can guess the song.
I'm speechless. I think it's... No, it's not Love Is a Many Splendored Thing. I'm at a loss.
You are at a loss. Well, you can find out that it's definitely not Love Is a Splendored Thing if you tune in to KHOI 89.1 FM tonight at 8:30. All right, Mike Murphy, what kind of music does Bernie Sanders listen to?
What kind of music? I'm going to say progressive rock.
You're right. So do you think that Bernie should tune in to You Name It this Thursday?
Absolutely.
And why?
Because there'll be progressive rock from 2 to 4 p.m. First hour studio recording, second hour live.
And what is progressive rock anyway?
Well, it's rock that's probably more complex music, based kind of on classical and jazz, more than just three chords kind of thing. And sometimes, because of that, it takes a little bit longer to develop themes, so sometimes the songs are quite a bit longer.
Yes, that was what my research discovered, that the songs are quite long.
Anna and Mike, does that mean you can hold that rock in the palmer of your hand?
Look at Mike Murphy. He's not even looking at you right now, Mike Nuts. He can't even look at you right now. But speaking of looking at you, what's happening on Thursday with Carol Horowitz?
Well, I understand she's going to have some special guests on KHOI Previews the Arts Thursday at noon. Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey, the two amazing Iowa artists, musical artists, who will be doing a benefit for KHOI on May 9th. And so this is a great sneak preview into that, and that's Thursday at noon.
Thursday at noon, lots to listen to. And as we come to the end of this Tune In Tuesday segment, I'm going to circle back selfishly to my show about the importance of storytelling with this quote from Nat King Cole, who said, "I'm an interpreter of stories. When I perform, it's like sitting down at my piano and telling fairy stories." So if you want to listen to storytelling from the piano's perspective, tune in to All Things Pianos and Beyond today at 9 a.m. on KHOI's YouTube page and by, of course, tuning in to 89.1 FM. And as the world begins at a kitchen table, we invite you to sit with us at the KHOI table by tuning in to listen to music and heart-to-heart conversations and learn about the world of science and other topics. It is time for Anna Bonanda to split. So next time, I hope that your days are connected to a community of love, care, and support. That is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me. So back to you, Mike Metz.
Well, thank you, Anna. And to remind our listeners that concert is a kickoff for our fund drive this spring, the 9th through the 23rd. So we'll be chatting with our listeners and see what we can do about helping our funds. Pat?
And for more information, go to our website, khoifm.org. We need to acknowledge Stevens Auditorium for co-sponsoring the Chad Elliott Bo Ramsey concert. And this concert is made possible by a grant from the Ames Commission on the Arts. So it's a great opportunity. Go to the website, be included, and you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Our website is khoifm.org. KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media.
And this program is produced by Lynn Carey and Ursula Rudenberg and engineered by Michael Murphy. Thank you, Mike. You heard from Luke Ulrich, and he's a proprietor of Great Plains Millwork. You also heard from Susan Guiazda and Damian Pregitzer. I have been your host, Mike Metz.
Please consider becoming a member of this fine community radio station with your financial support. Go to khoifm.org and press the yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member.
And Anna?
Yep. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, Oma makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI. And
see you again
on the radio.